I thought, well, what better way than to acknowledge, you know, two aspects of Mother? So we'll start with that. So that means, in Buddhist teaching terms, conventional and the ultimate, two aspects of reality. This is the two truth teaching. So usually we think about mothers in conventional terms. I mean, we all have a mother. So mothers love unconditionally. So that's, you know, that keep that word in mind, unconditional. Yeah. Mothers love us unconditionally. They nurture. And they teach us about this or that, about values. They pass on language. And you know, they instruct us in, you know, the labeling and naming of, you know, conventional items. You know, they're our first teachers with language. Not only do they pass on values of good or bad, but they also help us cope and survive. But more importantly, they help us grow and flourish. Mothers are compassionate. At least that's the ideal mother. If we think of Mother Teresa, she's a modern-day bodhisattva and has been called out as one in Teigen's book on Faces of Compassion. He writes about the bodhisattvas. Mother Teresa is certainly an exemplar of bodhisattva behavior. And we might even see our own mothers as bodhisattvas. Sometimes when you think about all the struggles of rearing a family and now in modern day of working and balancing the act that we all as mothers have to do, we can have a deeper appreciation for their role and their gifts. So how each of us responds to thoughts about Mother really depends on our relationship to our mother. No doubt some of you today have some very positive thoughts about your mother, but there might also be some thoughts that are quite painful in thinking of Mother. Whatever it is, I think that thinking about our mothers, in effect, we honor our mothers through our acknowledgement of our dependence on them. Of course, we, you know, show our love and appreciation. Sometimes it comes in the form of a gift. Sometimes it's just, you know, the gift is a phone call, might be a Hallmark card, might be chocolates, might be some desired, you know, item that Mother wanted. The plumbing worked on. That's what mothers want. The plumbing in the kitchen sink needs to be fixed. That's what they would ask for. Can you fix it? So mothers, you know, aren't necessarily materialistic, but, you know, they work in that realm. So we each try in some way today to think about how we can express our gratitude to our mother. And in cases where Mother isn't alive anymore, we still acknowledge Mother in some way. Some people go to grave sites and place flowers on the stone, or, you know, but others may just remember Mother for all the gifts. So I was thinking about that even in my own life about my mother's gifts. And my mother was a very generous person, and certainly to me, being the middle child here. I had two older brothers and a younger sister. And my mother really shared with me the religious life. She shared with me, the life of daily practice of prayer. You know, in the evening we said the rosary, and we had church on Sunday that we went to, and novenas, special occasions. We even did ceremonies. We did in May. We did ceremonies to the Blessed Mother. So I mean, it's quite an elaborate ceremony. And she also then gave me something which I'm very grateful for, and that was she gave me my life in a way that I never would have expected, and that was she. In my teens, I think I was struggling. I couldn't quite figure out what a woman was supposed to be. I didn't like the norms of society, of what this was. I was raised in the 50s. And so, you know, I just didn't really accept that what culture was telling me were the appropriate norms. Mother was a stay-at-home mom. Of course, my mother wasn't. But, you know, that's what everybody else did. And that mothers, you know, were, did certain jobs. You know, there was stay-at-home moms, and then you had to do certain jobs only. And at that time, my mother gave me a book called The Feminine Mystique, which set the mind off and liberated it, indeed. So for that, you know, I thought, now that's my mothers helping their children flourish. So it was definitely, I fought being a secretary all my, you know, teenage years. You know, no way was I going to be a secretary. Only took personal typing in summer school. Only for my own benefit, not to be someone's secretary. So anyway, I was not going to buy the story of society. Anyway, I was very grateful for Mother. But actually, there's more to just our, you know, natural mother. In Tibetan Buddhism, you know, there's a practice called Lojong, which is a practice about exchanging self for other. It's really a practice of compassion, to put yourself in another's place, right? Exchange self for other. And often this practice is associated with the notion of rebirth, about seeing every being as your mother. So that's pretty encompassing. Right? There's a practice of actually, when you encounter another person, of seeing them or acknowledging them as Buddha. And, it's a mental exercise, but nevertheless, it's one that helps us remember that each being comes out of oneness. Prajna Paramita. So, recognizing that as a practice is one of the things that a bodhisattva can do to develop compassion. Compassion that goes beyond the immediate family, the people we care about, our friends, you know, and people we know, to extend that circle to a much broader circle. And you would be surprised. While the practice seems rather superficial, over time you actually can start forming some identification with some of the experiences people are having, with the emotions, the feelings, and you start seeing humanness, you know, in them, and recognizing they're just like you. How do you want to be treated? How can you treat them back? So this is a practice in the interconnectedness of all being. It's a way to start seeing all creatures, all living beings, really, as Mother Buddha. Recently, the former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, maybe some of you know him, Norman Fisher, has written a book, I think it's titled Training in Compassion, Zen Teaching on the Practice of Lojong. So now it's from a Zen perspective. So I haven't read it, but I put it out there if any of you want to pursue practicing this equanimity that will bring up the compassion for all beings. So it's also been said that anybody who's experienced, you know, some awakening, you know, the perfection of wisdom, the precious mirror, that out of that experience you can start to realize in your life the working of the Prajnaparamita through prajna that arises in the form of the perfections. So the perfections are also paramitas, and there are six of them. The perfection of wisdom, really, they say that generosity is the one that is the foundation, but of all of the six paramitas. Everybody knows the paramitas? Yeah? Okay. So, no? Generosity. Then the next one would be, I want to say effort, but it's really goodness or morality. Then the third would be patience or tolerance. The fourth being commitment or energy, and the fifth being meditation, sixth is wisdom. But wisdom permeates the paramitas. And in their perfected state, they arise naturally out of prajnaparamita. In other words, you can start experiencing the emptiness of what is arising. This is definitely something that is experienced, and you can read about it, but really that is the really, if we have a goalless goal in Zen, it's, you know, realization, and it is about realizing for yourself your true nature. There's a wonderful book about the mother of all Buddhas, and it's written by Lex Hickson with a foreword by Robert Thurman. It's absolutely an amazing book in the sense that it points to ways, I think, to actually realize Prajnaparamita, but also extol the virtues of Prajnaparamita, and then, you know, of course there are practices, but and some meditations in this book. What was interesting for me is in considering the mother of all Buddhas for today's talk, it's actually kind of difficult because it's something that we experience. And when you think about, you know, we spend a lot of time in the conventional world, so it's hard to really discuss the, you know, ultimate reality or absolute. But in the case of one example of something that comes from this text is about the perfection of patience. And this is how it's defined in the Prajnaparamita Sutra. Patiently accepting the ultimate elusiveness of truth, which always remains beyond any finite or conventional teaching, beyond doctrine, explanation, description, or designation. Something similar is Tigan's definition. He's the person who authored the Bodhisattva Archetypes or Faces of Compassion, and he refers to patience as the tolerance for being with the ungraspable, the inconceivable change that is occurring moment by moment in everything, you know, that is in its perfected state. So the practices of prajna, of the paramitas, the perfections, are really, we can start in our everyday, you know, conventional world, and then, you know, you can see that there is a continuum of practices that will, at some point, hopefully, bring you to the experience of the perfected state. But there, and I think over time, even, yeah, I think Cliff has shared with me Colvin's thoughts on paramitas. And it's quite wonderful, very fresh interpretation. So, consider the paramitas as a way to enter into prajnaparamita and experience the perfection of wisdom. As practitioners, we know that the Mahayana path is really about delusion. It's about the delusion of duality, that, you know, how we think. Everything is in dualistic terms. It's either good or bad, right or wrong, up or down. It's conceivable or not, you know, it's ungraspable or not. There are endless dualistic pairs that we can come up with, and that's the way the mind naturally seems to be wired. And of course, there's one for samsara and for nirvana. And, we use the term nirvana sometimes to consider it as a perfected state, and yet it is in opposition to samsara. So really what's being transcended when we talk about prajnaparamita is that you've transcended dualism of nirvana and samsara. And that is the dualism of birth and death, of the way we see things in our convention, with our conventional mind, because it actually is beyond everyday mind that we experience this prajnaparamita. So it's a kind of a I would say like another tweaking of the technicalities, you know, of when we start to talk about nirvana and samsara, and depending on the context of what you're reading, it may make more sense in its use in one way or another. So it was, I think, DJ Suzuki who also saw that as a problem and, use a different word to translate it as birth and death as opposed to nirvana. So it's something that just you know, for your mind to work on sometimes. Have a spare moment, you can think about nirvana versus samsara. But the point here is that we do take refuge in prajna paramita, and I think the Heart Sutra that we chanted this morning is actually a distillation of the Prajna Paramita Sutra, which is, well, in one version it's 8,000 lines. The Heart Sutra is like 250 or so characters, so it's, you know, been distilled down. So you can see the content, though, is really all about wisdom. And as they say in the Diamond Sutra, you know, that wisdom, prajna paramita, is the perfect enlightenment. And that's where prajna paramita is the birthplace of Buddhas. So there is a process, actually, of how we do this, how we take refuge in Buddha. And you know, in thinking about taking refuge in Buddha, I was considering the times when, you know, we are experiencing suffering and we're really deep in and mired in the entanglement of suffering, and it's hard to get out. And the mantra that is in the Heart Sutra, you know, gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisattva, is the mantra to relieve all suffering. And it's a practice that when we call upon it as bodhisattvas, it actually can and does work for us. That you can move through the suffering when you chant that mantra in the midst of your suffering. There can be relief. So Buddhas know, you know, there's nothing to be attached to. And in knowing that there's no attachment, that is how they have experienced the perfected state, because they have let go of the attachments that may fill our own lives, the attachments of things that we desire or beliefs that we have, feelings, emotions, a lot of the trouble, I think, comes, though, from our ideas. I think a lot of it we can get beyond the stuff of our lives, you know, the materialism, especially, you know, as we, you know, sit more in this practice, we, you know, that's the part that's easier to see. But the part that's more difficult, of course, are the beliefs and ideas, the conditioning of our life. That's the part that's really hard to let go of. It's hard to see. Sometimes, you know, we just go through life, we don't even see it. And then one day we may wake up and have some insight about how our thoughts, our beliefs, are causing suffering for ourselves and then for others. It's kind of shocking when it happens. And it continues. It's probably because you've sat off for some time, you know that, you know, you get the grossest level of suffering comes first, you know, that to your mind when you're sitting and you're a new practitioner. So comes up, and you may experience the more dramatic insights about those, you know, what you're seeing and realizing. But It's like an onion, you know, they describe it. You just have some experience and you realize, you know, the truth of that. And then it takes a little while before that onion is peeled away some more and you experience another insight about some other conditioning that you may have been struggling with. So this is a process that, you know, never seems to end, but it does become more than a way of life in the way that one approaches and experiences everyday life. It's not so, it becomes an effortless effort. You actually can be awake to the activities that consume your day from morning until evening and take them each for what they are without grasping mind. And that transcends you and transforms the way you're going to interact with people, because you're no longer in this tug of war this way or that, and you can just be there with another. And that's what Prajnaparamita is really all about. It's about experiencing what is. What is? I have enough time here to tell you a story about Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa is a very revered teacher in the Tibetan tradition. I think it's close to the time around Dogen, very close. Lama Tsongkhapa studied Nagarjuna. And he had a big insight because he realized the role of love and compassion and how it actually worked in the world. He saw how it really was so interconnected with all beings that actually beings help bodhisattvas. It's the idea of giver, receiver, and gift. They are, by their presence, they are helping bodhisattvas, who in turn respond to help the sentient beings. And so they are the vehicles in some way of developing compassion. It's just very important insight for him, because then you see in the interconnectedness and experience the interconnectedness of all beings, as well as how compassion arises in a non-discriminate way. Lama Tsongkhapa also had another major awakening, and that was to the nature of emptiness. The Tibetan word that was used I think, is voidness. And up until that point, that Lama Tsongkhapa thought that that meant, empty, or, nothing was going on, and it was void. But actually, he came to realize that it was more dynamic. It wasn't empty, a void in the conventional way that we use the term. And sometimes I think even in the West we all struggle with the word emptiness. It's so much connotation around that. But the more you study and practice, then you can understand the dynamic workings of emptiness. So it's actually from that basis that Lex Hickson writes some of this book. So he has some clarity and about some very key teachings that are found in the Prajnaparamita Sutra. It's a very powerful sutra. So I wanted to share with you some other names for Prajnaparamita. Although, you know, actually, the pervasive theme of this book of Prajnaparamita is themelessness. So there's another one for Prajnaparamita. But here are some other names that you probably have all heard. Reality, with the big R. Pure presence. I think Eckhart Tolle uses that one. Pure presence. Truth. And then there's the indescribable, ungraspable, inconceivable, incomparable, baseless, nameless, unconditioned, and stainless. And that's just a subset of what is out there. Sometimes it's suchness, is another word, a little more contemporary. So what can we do? What do we learn today about, you know, honoring our mothers, both in the conventional and ultimate sense? So we know that if we turn towards wisdom, if we turn toward the Dharma, that in itself is practicing. But in the Prajnaparamita, there's some specific instructions about what bodhisattvas do. And so I'm going to quote for a minute just a brief paragraph about mature bodhisattvas. I guess the word's mature. The bodhisattva will always maintain a motherly, consecrated mind to the constant protection, education, maturing of conscious beings, inviting and guiding them along the path of all-embracing love. This Mahayana mind never succumbs to fear, anxiety, or depression, and is never overwhelmed by strange adventures of awareness in the three realms of relativity: the mundane, or desire, sublime form, or formlessness. In a poetic form, we have our ancestor Ru Jing, who is from China. He's Dogen's teacher, and he has this poem for us. He says, "The whole body is a mouth hanging in space, not caring which way the wind blows, east, west, south, or north. All day long, it speaks of Prajnaparamita for everyone. Ding dong, ting tong, ting tong." Now we know where Dogen gets his sense of humor. So may you experience Mother's Day today from the experience of Prajnaparamita, each day and each moment of each day going forward. So I wish for you, mothers, all of you, mothers of all beings, Take care. I think we have some time for questions, huh? The timekeeper's right there.
We have, it's 12:28.
Oh, good. 2 minutes. 2 minute warning. I love it. Yes, Edith.
Given that it's Mother's Day, and you know, appreciating all that you mentioned about paramitas and lojong, there doesn't seem to much emphasis on the practice of gratitude in Buddhism, or mm-hmm. is there?
Well, maybe through mindfulness practice, you know, we can do that. I think many of our ancestors do offer, you know, incense to their ancestors in gratitude. And so there are stories of that. You hear stories of gratitude in the koans. It may be just that we don't know about all of them. We don't have the same exposure to, you know, all of the stories, like, you know, Zen stories, like we, or, you know, just generally Buddhist history, like we do from we all know about the Bible. I mean, you know, everybody knows all the stories, both Old Testament and New. I mean, they're in comics, they're in movies, they're, you know, where are Zen stories? You know, well, although we have comic books now. Comic books, right? So, we don't, you know, even we don't have much in the way of chants either, I mean, singing and all that stuff. We have Christmas carols. So, you know, I think, you know, it's really a cultural issue right now, but hopefully, you know, give us another 100 years, maybe something will be different. I'm hoping, but keep sharing about gratitude. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Thank you for that very deep and interesting insights. I want to get back to something quickly before we run out of time. Back to the way that we get into our beliefs. You were touching upon
mm-hmm.
how our sitting practice can help us become more aware of what's kind of coming up,
mm-hmm.
but the real stuff is associated with these beliefs that are not so easily seen. It's just like in computer jargon, it's the operating system,
mm-hmm.
subroutines, rules. Therefore, this. And so my question is, what are some clues that might help identify what those beliefs are, so that because it's sort of in the shadow self.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some clues. I mean, you get some clues. I think we all get some. I mean, you know, one of them is like, you know, you get angry. You get upset when people don't accept what you just said, or or the way you behaved, or, you know, they may turn away, they may just, you know, flip you off, you know. I mean, there's just a lot of things people aren't giving you the clues about. So some of it is internal. Some of it is when you know, the emotions come up. That means you're stuck. Something is happening that is causing you to be stuck. And that's a place to look further.
So let's take that right there.
Okay.
I'm stuck. So, but still, that doesn't necessarily say here's why. Because
well,
you still want to go back further.
Yes,
to see what's sticking you.
Yes. So if you can. Oh, that hurt. Yes. Yeah. That's a very good process. So sometimes we can't even face it. Sometimes we absolutely can't see, we just, you know, ignore it. I mean, you know, it's like, we do blaming. We'll say, well, that's their problem, or that's their issue, or they're this or that. You know, we do naming, labeling, calling people names, that kind of stuff. So we say that's their problem, right? It's not our problem. So that's aversion, you know, so we've turned away from it. But other times, you may be more receptive. You may even say, oh, what's going on there? And you may not do it right away. It may kind of turn you and kind of like, you know, feel like a big lump somewhere in your body that, you know, it's like, well, that didn't feel so good. What happened there? You know, what's really bothering me? And then you can look at what triggered it. So that's called the other dependent reality. See, so nothing arises separate. That's the fundamental teaching in Buddhism. Nothing arises separate. Everything is interconnected. So what if you can use these tools about reality? So when something comes up, you can, and you know, you feel like you're stuck, you have to say, well, what did I imagine? What was I thinking? What did I impute? What were the appearances of things? What went on there? Because you might have imagined something about a situation, about a person that wasn't true. And that's generally what we do. That's part of the Lakavatara Sutra. It's all about projections. How things appear to us is not how they exist in reality.
Okay, so one more step then. How do we get
okay, so
if something seems so solid, so
right, so now you can look at another aspect of reality is the other dependent. The dependent, they call it dependent origination. What triggered, you know, what was the stick? You know, and you can look at that and say, somebody may have challenged me. Somebody may have, you know, used harsh words. Maybe they hurt me, you know. Maybe they said something I didn't think was true or I didn't believe. So you look at what was the other dependent reality. Other dependent that gave impetus or give rise to your emotion where you reacted. And then the next step is, of course, if you can figure the other dependent reality, then the next one is to see it as empty. That, oh, I hear the bell. It's empty too. And to realize that it's empty. In other words, that emotion that you experience, a reaction, arose in dependence on something else. And so you need to look in further into, well, why is that the case? Why do I, you know, if it's not solid, if it's empty, this belief that I have. See, the other dependent reality or other dependent characters, sometimes it's called, actually is the glue that connects your imagined reality with emptiness. That's how it's connected. What triggers it? How did it arise? So it's really important to take yourself through the process and then to see the emptiness of it. Now, if you can actually link it back to you had a belief or you believe that, you know, people should behave in this way. I mean, there's some conditioning in us that says we have expectations about others. They can't behave this way. And if they cross that line, then we don't like it. And we react in a certain way. So it could be a belief, but it could be also some kind of a idea about, you know, the way we think, or some conditioning about our upbringing, or, you know, whatever. There's just, and our conditioning is so deep that, you know, we have to continually do the work. And that's what the work of the Bodhisattva is. It's to take these tools about reality that we know about the appearance of things and how that causes us problems because we misinterpret. We are putting stuff on everything. We are projecting our world. And you have to start seeing through your projections, seeing how you project all kinds of things. It's not even on simple things like, you know, oh, the cup, you know, before you know it, he's telling me it's peppermint tea, but, you know, I've got all kinds of ideas that just popped into my head about this teacup and this plate. We do it all the time. Some of it is rather neutral, right? Some of it not so neutral. The peppermint tea doesn't really care. But you might care, or you might care if I react or respond differently than you expect. So you just get wise about this kind of, and see what you're up to. See what your projections are. And see how difficult those projections can make your life. They're pretty easy to let go once you find them. You know, well, easier. So, give it a shot. Yes.
It's like therapy.
Yep. Zen therapy. You got it.
Or just seeing a therapist. Sounds like it can help.
Yep. Some people, you know, respond to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, there are a lot of people who say that confusing Zen with therapy is a pitfall and a dead, you know, real mistake.
Yeah. Right.
And
then Zen really doesn't try to provide a therapeutic result or experience.
But yet some of the very early sutras, like the Sambandhimocchana Sutra and the Lakavatara Sutra, these all teach about the mind, the way the mind works. And so it's up to us to realize the nature of mind. And these are just ancestors pointing the way, saying, this is it, this is it. It's over here. I think this is it for lunch. I should go.